So that, and a big hello to our asynchronous audience who is going to listen to this, or of course the synchronous audience will be wanting to replay these words of wisdom from our moderator and your questions later on. So Athabasca University is pleased to sponsor this Open Access Week. We've had four great presentations. They're all recorded, and I'll ask Tony to punch in the URL where those recordings are available so that you can recommend them to some of your colleagues who don't happen to be here. And without further ado, I think I'd like to introduce our speaker for today. He's generously added my name to the bottom, because I've done a presentation or two on open education resources, and we sort of, in the spirit of open resource sharing, we pooled our slides together, which is why you see that number of 60 slides, which means Rory's going to be going quickly through those. Rory McGreal is a good friend of mine and colleague at Athabasca University. He's the Associate Vice President of Research and has been involved in securing many of the research projects at Athabasca University. He's a scholar in his own right. He's in educational technology. He's published on learning objects, has quite an influential book on learning objects, and he does research on mobile learning, as well as having a strong background in distance education from running Teleeducation New Brunswick and Contact North in former lifetimes. Rory is active on the keynote circuit and well known around the world, and he's presently got a bug in his bonnet about open educational resources. So we'll turn the mic over to him. You can't interrupt him directly because he has to release the mic. So if you do have a question, please raise your hand by the little green arrow at the bottom of the participant window, and then he will click off and turn the mic over to you, or you can put in a text comment. So welcome, Rory.
Well, hello everyone. Thank you for that kind introduction, Terry, and thank you, Tony, for organizing these weekly sessions. May I assume that you just want me to continue on then?
Yes, go right ahead, Rory.
Will do. Today's topic is open educational resources, as it's been all week, and I'd like to introduce myself, and there's Terry, as open scholars. So we're trying to push open scholarship as much as possible and promote it among different institutions. And why are we doing this? And the key point is that we believe that the world's knowledge is a public good in general, and we are supported in this belief by the original meaning of copyright, and basically that works belong to the public and that authors have a right to exploit that work for a limited period of time. Today, the World Wide Web in particular is providing an extraordinary opportunity for everyone in the world to share, use, and reuse the world's knowledge. And this is being promoted very much by the Hewlett Foundation and the Open Educational Resources. Here's a question for everyone, because you quite often hear about people talking about how technology is destroying human community, etc. What technology has done more to destroy human community than any other? And I'd like you to just think about that for a while. The car, yes. The airplane, yes. And of course, if you were in the U.S., some people would say the gun. Landmines, the air conditioner, a great group. Well, let me suggest to you what the technology I believe has done more to destroy human community. And could it be the portable book? and Albertus Menoudius came up with the idea of the book that anyone could have. It wasn't Gutenberg. Gutenberg came up with a book that was locked in at the front of the lecture room. But Albertus Menoudius came up with the portable book that anyone could. And once this book became popular, people could then learn without entering into a human community. And they could learn on their own, and that's why these books were banned from universities in Europe for about 150 years, because they destroyed the community. And that's a thought to think about as we're discussing open education resources. Of course, the definition from UNESCO is the open provision of educational resources enabled by information and communications technologies and available for use and adaptation. So that's the key, and one of the key words there is not just use, but adaptation. So the idea is that your open educational resource, if you put on your license that other people can't adapt it, it's not really a full open educational resource according to the UNESCO definition. Types of open education resources can be many, from learning objects to units of study, textbooks, scholarly articles. For example, IRODL, the International Review of Research in Distance Learning. Multimedia objects can be open education resources, so it can be courses, programs, full curriculum. It can be tools, free and open source tools. So there's quite a range of items that can be considered open educational resources. And the idea of granularity comes in here, where the resources can come in many sizes. So for example, it could be a simple photograph or a diagram. It can be articles from open access publications, a game or a simulation, a multimedia, unit of learning. For example, the IMS learning design supports units of learning. Lessons, modules, courses, and full program. So you come from one tiny object. For example, this one, provided as to us by Norm Friesen, is here's an example of an open education resource. This photograph is open because it's in the public domain. It was produced in 1839, and this could be used for open education for in a module about Paris or about the year 1839, about architecture, about photography, etc., etc. And the interesting thing about this photo is that if you look in the bottom left corner, you'll see a man having his shoes shined. And this is the first picture of a human being that we have, the earliest known picture of a human being. So again, this would be considered an open education resource. So you put these, if we refer to those as components, we put them into lessons. And again, the whole lesson is an educational resource, and you put the lessons into modules, and the modules are also at a different level of granularity, and you put the modules into a course, again another level, and even a program. So all of these, at whatever level of granularity, could be considered open education resources, even to the extent of a full program can be made available open and free on the internet. So, the open education resources are open. That means they can be augmented, you can add to them, you can edit them, you can customize them, they can be aggregated, they can be reformatted, and the whole idea on the internet is the idea of mashups, So when you have an open educational resource, you're free to do what you want with it. And we say mostly because in some cases people put limitations on their open education objects. And I'd refer everyone to have a look at Scott Leslie's video on that. He has a very good video on that. David Wiley mentions the four R's of the functionalities of open education resources. Reuse, you use the work exactly as you found it. You can rework it, alter or transform the work. You can remix it, combine the work with other works, or you can redistribute it, that is, share with others. And Hodgkins also mentions another use is repurpose. That is, use the work as you found it, but use it in a different context. So for example, somebody comes up with a statistics course for psychology, and you would reuse that in another statistics course, exactly the way you found it. Or you can take it as you found it and put it into a math course and repurpose it. So it's, although it's originally made for psychology, you can use it in another subject area. So that's the idea of functionality of open education resources. Open education resources are being used for world development, and this is why UNESCO is so interested in them. They have the goal of developing together a universal education resource available for the whole of humanity, and they hope that this open resource for the future can mobilize the whole of the worldwide community of educators. That is, if we all work together on this and start opening up our materials as much as possible, this would be a fantastic tool for development. And right now, there are millions of open education resources that are available. And I have on the picture here just a number of the sites that you can go to find these resources. And some of them are full university courses from accredited institutions. And others are parts of courses and modules, and some are just components. But there is a huge and wide variety, growing variety, of open education resources. And one of the sad things is that they are not being used as much as they could be. And people are continuing to spend their time creating resources that are available free now on the World Wide Web. And the OER providers can be divided into different groups. You have the large providers like the World Lecture Hall or MIT, and they're by particular institutions, Connections, for example, and then others that are large, and it's the community that controls them, like Ariadne in Europe, or WikiEducator, or the OER Commons. And then you have small ones where individual institutions like the Maricopa Learning Exchange or Athabasca University, where we have a few learning objects available. And then you have smaller ones that are communities like Kuriki or the Content Observatory Systems services. So this gives you an idea of the type of open education resource providers that are out there. The rationale for using open education resources has been, this rationale has been developed by the Open University in the UK. And they look at it as an opportunity. And they feel there's a real risk in doing nothing and not participating in the open education resource world. They believe that OERs can address technology and globalization. They can be used as a test bed for technology and work processes. They can attract external funding, and the whole world can be used as a resource. And one of the key aspects that they're looking at is brand promotion. That is the Open University UK, and Athabasca quite recently too, has gained a lot of publicity by participating in the Open Education Resource, positive publicity. And it shows it can be used to demonstrate the quality of the materials of the institution. So all of these things are possible. And another rationale for using your open education resources is why not? What it's sort of sometimes you can ask people a question, they answer you with a question, and I'm saying, you know, why not? What's there to be gained by closing your material and not letting anyone use it? So there's ownership and licensing issues, and one of the familiar problems is who owns the resources, the educators or the institutions? And people get inflated expectations. They sort of think their little module or their little piece of content is going to turn them into multimillionaires or make them big bucks at least. And both institutions and educators have been guilty of this. But what we found is that if you try to partner or collaborate with other institutions, if you start getting into ownership and licensing problems, you get yourself into a can of worms, and what happens is most of the money goes to the lawyers. It becomes almost impossible to collaborate. For example, if you have two institutions or companies, whatever, working together, you may have two or four problems in getting the licensing sorted out. And but if you add a third one, that isn't another two or four problems. It's four times four, 16 problems. And you add another one, another institution, it's four times 16 problems. And the problems just amount and amount until it becomes impossible for you to collaborate. So one of the major arguments for universities to support the open access is that it facilitates collaboration. Nobody's arguing over the intellectual property. New problems. OERs, they're not journal articles in particular. Journal articles, for the most part, there's limitations on reworking them. So some things cannot be as completely open as other things. One question is attribution critical? And I think that's very important for educators, is that they get the right attribution because that helps increase their reputation and their opportunities for advancement within their field. So attribution is important. Commercial exploitation, some people don't like companies to make money off their material, so they limit that unless they share it, so they limit the they choose a non-commercial license. So they're when we're talking about opening up, there are certain levels of opening up your material. So you have different ownership models in universities. You have the institutional, where institutions claim that the material is all under work for hire, and the law is that unless there is a written agreement to the contrary, your work done during the course of your employment belongs to the employer. And many universities have a shared one where they share between the faculty member and the university. And these often can be quite unworkable, and it's been referred to sometimes as the tragedy of the anti-commons rather than the tragedy of the commons. The individual academic could own the materials, and that certainly is the case in many of our universities. And that creates problems when, for example, if the professor leaves that university and goes somewhere else, then it makes it difficult for universities to continue using the same course materials. Other problems come in when you have multiple authors of who has the right to use them, etc. And I'll get into further the whole idea of prejusage, where we don't bother enforcing rights. And this brings in the concepts of the copyleft or the public domain. Funding models are possible. People are, one of the big arguments against it, against open education resources, is who's going to pay for it. And Stephen Downs came up with a list of different ways that open education can be funded. And one of them would be an endowment from philanthropic organizations like the Hewlett Foundation. Merlot has a membership model where each member pays an annual fee. Wikipedia has come about through a donation from a philanthropist. A producer contribution, where the producer of the resource just gives it to the community. And in fact, this is how all of these big companies like Elsevier are making their money now. The professors contribute their research to the publishing company, and then the publishing company takes that and sells it back to the university libraries, and they're making millions of dollars off it. So this is one way we could reverse that and contribute it to the open access community and not charge our universities. And our university libraries can come up with it. So others are sponsorships. iTunes University is sponsored. There's government funding, and what I just referred to, institutional. So libraries are spending huge amounts of money now to access databases of research, and the research is all donated to the companies by academics, and that money could be used for open access if we can get our act together. The Creative Commons license, which I've referred to before, allows you to open up your course materials, but you reserve some rights, and there are three that are the most common. Is the right of attribution, that is, you can use it, but you must say who made it and who it owns it. Derivatives are, can they or can they not make derivatives of your work? And the other one is commercial use, which is the one that quite often is the one that people don't allow, that people are quite free and willing to open up their creative works, but they're not very interested in allowing somebody to make money from it. So here's a list of the different Creative Commons licenses. There's a spectrum of possibilities, all the way between full copyright or all rights reserved and the public domain. So you've got over here on the left, you've got full copyright, you control everything, and over on the right, you've got anyone can do anything they want with it, for whatever reason, without any restriction. And I would recommend to people is we should be thinking of putting our materials out in the public domain. It facilitates reuse and repurposing. People are worried about attribution. I mean, there's an ethical responsibility to attribute, and people don't have a problem with that. And in fact, if you take work of somebody else and pretend it's your own, that is unethical, and certainly in any academic field, this would be considered very unprofessional and could cause you to lose your position. So attribution is not really needed. That's done anyway. And of course, people, they don't want the commercial entities to use it, but quite often, for-profit is not always evil. Especially in developing countries, if some burgeoning entrepreneur can find a way of getting your material out to the public and making a few dollars out of it, this can be a very good thing. It's not always the big evil Elseviers or Pearsons that are taking your work and using it. And again, I put that forward to you is why put it in the public domain? Why not put it in the public domain? What is the downside for you or for anyone to put your work into the public domain? I really don't see much of the arguments about that. You know, unless somebody feels they're going to make a fortune on their work, or even a substantial amount of money, which very few academics feel like or do get, what's the point? So there are problems with using OERs at the present stage, and some of them are outlined here. To date, there's little take-up by conventional teachers. That is, they're out there, and teachers don't know about them. I'm surprised, and I've been talking to people who support the idea of open access resources, and they have no idea of just how much is out there. And although they support the principle of creating it and opening up their materials, they're very shy and reluctant to use the materials that are out there. Some say, well, there's little reward or recognition for the authors, and I think that is changing. I mean, one example we have is, for example, at Athabasca University, both Terry Anderson and Muhammad Ali have received incredible rewards and recognition for being authors. Invitations as speakers, their reputation is enhanced, etc., etc. So, again, that could be a problem at the early stages, but quite often it becomes an asset. And there's the problem that few learners engage with the content. And again, that is really up to the teachers and how they put the content forward and how they make use of it. The business case we've discussed before is how can we make this sustainable? How can we continue to produce open education resources and have them? And again, the problem is there's little use and there's little remixing and reposting. And I think part of that problem is they're not really sure of the different licenses. I think most people are unclear about that they do have the right to do this. And I'm sure copyright offices in universities would even advise you not to remix and repost, that it's against copyright. I have a question here. I'll open it up.
Hi, Rory. It's Terry. I don't really have a question as much as maybe you can take a break and let the audience have a time to either comment or question on some of the ideas here. I thought this was the almost halfway through and a good one to look at. I wonder if anybody would like to share any either case stories or ideas about the problems with OERs that they've had experience with, and especially if they've had any solutions that they'd care to share with us. Just grab the mic if you have a comment. Okay, don't be shy. I know it's hard to ask the first question, so I will take the second question first.
Hi, Terry. It's Gina. I'm wondering if anyone at Athabasca and their research has looked at rewarding instructors for reuse or repurposing of existing resources.
I'll let Terry have an opinion on this, but I guess the reward I see is, and to give an example of one professor here who was creating a new course in green computing, and he found a whole course, open access course, in Moodle, which we use here, from a university in Australia, that he basically had to just tweak a little bit. So this saved him a whole semester's work. And I would think that that's a reward. I think that using the material, instead of having to develop your own material for your courses, that is a big reward in itself.
Yeah, I would agree, Rory, but unfortunately, we often underestimate the disruptive impact of these technologies. For instance, we often hire subject matter experts to, quote, write a course. And I've seen this in third world countries, distance education institutions too, is that people define themselves and their career and their own personal identity on their capacity to create original courses. So in fact, we have almost a disincentive to reuse, because then, you know, what am I? Am I no good? Or, you know, I'm being paid to develop this course. If I just import it from somebody else, then am I putting myself out of a job? So I think we have to change that. We've started by hiring somebody to look for replacements to at least our textbooks, if not our course content itself. So we're a long ways from there, but I think we got to really look at what motivates faculty and make sure that we're not building in disincentives rather than incentives. Thanks for the question.
And I would add to that many of the courses traditionally that we've done are really wraparounds of proprietary textbooks. And if that's what you're talking about is your course and you've created that course, I can't see that that is particularly valuable for your career advancement, as opposed to taking open access materials and using them in the course.
There's a text chat. I'm just scrolling up. I guess it was Sylvia asked whether the disincentive, and I'm a little bit following here. I'm a little lost. Some of the instructors are concerned about distortion of their work and having that attributed to them. So you release a course or an article, somebody remodifies it and leaves your name on it, and maybe they do a bungling job of it. Is that a real issue or something that people should be worried about, Rory, or is there a solution for that?
I think that the possibility is there, but it's, it's always there, but I don't see how having proprietary work will stop it. I think it's the same for proprietary work, that people can take your work and distort it. I've seen that happen. People distort my work or misinterpret what I'm trying to say, and I've seen that happen, and I don't think it has the issue the issue is there, whether it's open access or if it's copyrighted. If there's dishonest people who do that, and sometimes it's not dishonest people, if it isn't dishonest people and they distort your work, perhaps that opens up an opportunity for debate and spreading your use better. Or if they've totally mishmashed it up into something that you don't like at all, then you can just ask them to take your name off. I don't think people would be I'd be unwilling to do that. I just don't see that that issue is different from open access works as opposed to copyrighted works.
Yeah, I think that's a point well taken, Rory. So good, let's move along, and do feel free to raise your hand and or type into the text box. Go ahead, Rory.
So, one of the main solutions to the problems that we have with open education resources is let's create vibrant communities. Spread the word about open access and start building the community of users of open access and creators and users of open access. The idea of publishers versus reusers as publishers. Patrides and Guyon and Caraglani there, they noted that 88% were using their own content. This involved authors of their own content. And only 12% used content derived by others. And again, that's a problem for the open education resource community. Is why not? What is the fear of using other people's content? And again, I would point it out to traditional uses and fear of copyright that we're just so ingrained that you don't use other people's stuff because of copyright restrictions, that we just have not developed a culture of sharing and using other people's work yet. But the OpenLearn website in the U.S. is in the U.K. is an example where they have 402 units of open access material, and they give free access, and people from anywhere in the world can take this material and use it. And the Open Courseware Consortium, it just shows the growth from MIT, who started it all off, that now the members are offering nearly, as of 2008, the last date for this, over 8,000, and I'm sure there's over 10,000 courses available through the Open Courseware Consortium. So there's quite a bit to choose from. Michael Bowens talks to us about the political economy of peer production, and he talks about producing use value through the free cooperation of producers. And he refers to this as a third mode of production. It's neither for profit or public. And it's not exchange value as in dollars for the market, but in use value for a community. So as your material gets used more, you gain prestige within the community. And Chris Anderson of Wired Magazine talks about his taxonomy of free. And by this he means he looks at six different ways that we can make money from allowing free resources. And he's not just talking about education resources, he's talking about any kind of business area. And the first one he mentions, I guess it's his most famous, is the freemium. That is, you give a free version, and then there's a pro version that you pay for. And you see this a lot with, for example, iPhone apps, where you get the free version with one or two levels, and you can buy the whole version and get the full 20 or 30 levels, and different things like that. And what he says is that even if 99% just use the free version, you can still make money on the 1% who use it. And 1% of the users can support all the others. So if you just get money from a very small percentage, he's saying that that opens up the possibility. The other one is advertising, where you provide a special audience. So you offer up a free site giving information to different people, a small group, and advertisers really like to be able to target specific groups that they know would be more apt to buy their product. And so advertising can be used. The third way is cross subsidies. So you get a free lunch if you buy beer. So he's basically saying you go in, you buy your pint of beer, and they'll give you a free hot dog. And this could work in an educational context where materials are free if you pay tuition or you join a particular club or whatever. The other one is zero marginal cost, and online music is the best example of that, where the cost of producing it and distributing it is so low that it doesn't really enter into the problem as an expense. Labor exchange, and you can look at that for the Dig site, or Google 411, where the people basically contribute, and they create the site, and so their contribution is work, and they get something out of it, they put something into it. And I think that is a good model for open education resources in particular, is if your university or group is putting a lot into creating open education resources, they can take a lot out of it. And the Merlo, for example, is sort of on that. If you're a member, you can share in the resources. And there's a number like that. And finally, there's the gift economy, where dollars aren't everything, and you can, if you can afford it, give it away to people. So that there is different views of what is free and what isn't. And Alex Bruns talks about producers, that is from production to prod usage. And by that he means that users are active participants in the production of artifacts. And that, again, fits very nicely into our view of how we can build the open education resources. And he mentions as examples the open source movement, the Wikipedia, citizen journalism, blogs in particular, immersive worlds, and distributed creativity like the music video and Flickr open access sites, open sites. So with the producage, there's different models of how that can work. For example, Wikimedia, set up by a company, and the Wikimedia Foundation sets up a community. There's an initial IP contribution from public domain is another way that it goes into the mix of available things. People can make money out of these free things through commercial nonprofit or user-generated content. They mentioned The Sims as part of that. That is that people make money by producing things that other people using that particular product want to use. Red Hat has made a very successful commercial business out of the open source software, as Sun Microsystems is doing as well, and IBM to a great extent. Valuable, often commercial grade content is created, and commercial activities can be taken out by users themselves, and they can create new industries. The principles of producage, as put out by Axel Bruns, is they're community based, and this contributes more than any closed team. You get more out of it if you leave it open. You have a fluid heterarchy. That is, it's appropriate to personal skills or interests in loose subgroups, focusing on specific problem. So you get people who are interested in it and get them working on it, is basically what he wants to say. Unfinished artifacts, there's projects that are continually under development. The development follows evolutionary, iterative, and God forbid, palimpsestic paths, whatever that means. Maybe Terry can explain that to us later. Common property, individual rewards, contributors permit the non-commercial use or adaptation, further development, and people are rewarded by the status capital. So they're the different principles of prod usage, which sort of parallel and I guess explain in a different context some of the ideas put forward principally about the benefits of using open education resources. So some of the main areas that are supporting it, the OER Commons is a big one, the open education community for teachers, for learners. That's one of the ones we can go to. Another one is you can use the open education resources for profit making. And one of these is the Flat World Knowledge. And an Alberta company that we are working with at the moment, Lyrix Learning, is part of the Flat World Knowledge. I wouldn't say part, but they're partnered with them in developing it. And the idea is, their idea is, they put out a free online version, and then they charge for the print version or for a better quality online version, which I'm sort of suspicious of, because the online version that's free is very poor quality, and you sort of pay for the other versions. But it's one model that seems to be working so far, and we'll just have to follow it and see where it goes. So, will educators and learners produce? Well, social software it affords, but the idea of build it and they shall come, that rarely works. And unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of that with the open education resource community today. There's thousands, tens of thousands, even millions of free components out there, and they're just not being used. And my own belief is that it just hasn't caught on yet, that at some point we're going to reach a tipping point. So far the evidence is that you know, people are not using it, and some are arguing, and with justification, that maybe it just isn't going to work. And one of the questions is, recognition by your peers enough of a reward? And how can students use open education resources with accreditation? And that's a big question that is being posed now, is, so students, if they avail themselves of these free resources on the web for learning, how do they get credit and recognition for that if they, for example, follow a course that's fully online and fully freely available, they do the work, they gain the knowledge, and how do they accredit that? And that's one of the issues of today. Social software, social software like ELDGE is available that allow users to get to know each other, to produce artifacts together, to share information and generate knowledge together. And part of this, and one of the interesting aspects of social software, is that it's the learners and the teachers create it, and then they give it to the open education resource community. And I think there's a huge potential in that. They say that one of the best ways to learn is by doing. So especially in education departments, if our grad students and teacher candidates work together with their professors, can we create open educational resources for the community? And there's a huge amount of social software out there that people can be using. And it's growing all the time. Another question, and you get this from developing countries who are frightened of imperialism, is can we ensure that the open education resources are culturally appropriate? As Edmondson notes, the courses are cultural artifacts, and they're embedded with cultural values, preferences, characteristics, and nuances of the culture that designed them. And so if you're in Africa, are you going to be happy with the American view of history or sociology? Never mind that, if you're in Canada, are you going to be happy with the American view of history, sociology, psychology, etc.? I think it's a deeper issue for those type of subjects rather than perhaps pure math or science, but even there are certain cultural assumptions embedded in any learning. So when you're looking at cultural adaptation and the process model is, again, you've got the translation, and people think if it's in English, it doesn't need to be translated, but quite often things are specific to a certain country and they need to be globalized, so we need global English. Even if it is staying in English, never mind translating to other languages. Localization, relevant examples that are there, and again I mentioned about the green computing course that we took from Australia, and we're localizing it by adding on Canadian examples. But by the way, we're keeping the Australian examples as well, because it's good to know too about what things are happening in other places, so it's not totally localized. Modularization is to make it reusable in lower levels of granularity. So as you have a big course, a 3-credit course, or as they do in England, a course that might be the equivalent of 9 or 10 credits in North America, we need to break them down so as they can be used. And the origination, redesigned by locals for the local application. So all of those things are important. And we do have one hero. We haven't seen the money yet, but he's pledged $500 million for open education resources in U.S. colleges. So yes, we can, and there is hope. So there's a big move in the United States now for open education. And by the way, this is happening in other countries too. Holland has just come up with a huge, I'm not sure the exact amount, but a very large amount of money for open education resources in that country. And it is happening in other parts of Europe. So I think that, again, there's reason to believe that we're on the cusp of something very, a major change, and open education is very much part of that change.
Hi, Rory. Sorry to interrupt, but we do have only 5 minutes left, and I do want to wind up right on the hour, mostly because they're kicking me out of the hotel where I'm at. Well, at least I have to go right at one. But maybe there's people who would like some chance to comment. So can you quickly wind it up, and we'll see if there's a comment or question.
One more minute. So I'm just going to show you some of the sites, connections, WikiEducator. There's the UNESCO OER community, and you can go to their wiki and join the discussion group. We have the Technology Enhanced Learning Knowledge Research Institute at the Athabasca University, and we're working on open education. I'd like to point out the new online text from Athabasca University Press, Mobile Learning, Muhammad Ali, and Terry's award-winning book, The Theory and Practice of Online Learning, and the new one, The Designer's Log by Michael Power of the Laval University. And I'll finish off quickly with the story about the frog. As you put the frog in boiling water, they say, and if you wait for it to jump out, it won't jump out. If you heat up the water slowly, it won't jump out until it's cooked. And the reason I tell this story is because at some point you've got to jump, and if you don't jump, you're going to be cooked. And I think that open education is something that you need to jump for, and if you don't, you're going to be cooked. So let's put all this hype about change and transformation in perspective. It's underhyped. There's something coming after us, and I imagine it is something wonderful, as Danny Hillis of Wired Magazine has told us. And Francois Tavenis tells us that change is mandatory, survival is an option, make the right choice. So we're going to do that with open education resources are part of that change. And there's a few questions there for discussion. And I'll open it up now.
Great. Well, thank you, Rory. We only have a couple of minutes, but there's been some interesting discourse along the side, mostly people adding resources to your comments and explaining weird world words like palmist dick and other things. So I'm sure you haven't had a chance to follow through at all. But Tony Tin has just announced the winners of today's draw for two free T-shirts, Open Access Week T-shirts, and they're Simon Rudge and Jim from Aurora College. And Simone, if you can email your address, email to Tony, and he'll post his email address, then we'll get a postal address that we can send it to. And of course, we will also be giving one to Rory for presenting today. And but I am going to just turn the mic over. Rick had some challenges to OER in the question, but other people responded. So it's first come, first serve on the mic, and do please grab it and a comment or question to Rory. Well, you've lost your opportunities, folks, to interact in real time, but I'm sure that Rory, in fact, maybe Rory can punch in his own email to the text chat if you'd like to contact him, or you can just find him on Google at Athabasca University. Well, I think we're at the end. Thanks a lot for those who've participated this week and especially today. And I think it's been a very successful week in our first endeavor at the first ever Open Access Week. We plan to do a bigger and better one next year with an international set of speakers. And let me just thank Rory McGreal. I think it was an excellent set of slides, especially the ones that I did. Just kidding. And I welcome and I see people are applauding. Thank you very much for that. And without further ado, I guess I'll say goodbye for Open Access Week 2009 and hope to see you in 2010. Thanks again, all.
Goodbye. Thanks for your participation.